At 7 minutes past seven, throughout the next 2 hours, extensive coverage on the life and times of former Taoiseach Albert Reynolds, who has passed away. But now we'll go to Valerie Cox for It Says in the Papers.
Gardaí tracking 30 Irish jihadi fighters. That's the lead this morning for the Irish Independent, where Tom Brady, Shane Phelan and Tom Warden compile a report that 30 jihadi fighters are using Ireland as a base while travelling regularly to conflict zones in Syria and Iraq, according to Garda intelligence. It says the group is being kept under close surveillance by Gardaí here and also under watch abroad by international police agencies. And inside the paper, Shane Phelan writes about a fighter who claims to be half Irish, half Nigerian, and who has been using social media to advise potential recruits. Also on the front of the Independent, Niall O'Connor reports that the head of debt-laden Irish Rail has come under fire after it emerged that he is on holiday in Mauritius as unions prepare to bring the rail network to a halt. The paper said it has confirmed that David Franks won't return to Ireland until Monday, during the middle of the second day of planned industrial action involving over 2,000 train workers. That story makes the lead for the Irish Daily Mail with rail strike, you say? Ah, well, life's a beach. Rory Giblin reporting that Mr. Franks has decided to go ahead with his 10-day break despite receiving official strike notification from the National Bus and Rail Workers Union on August 1st, almost 2 weeks before he went to Mauritius. But one man who has already abandoned his family holiday and returned to Downing Street is UK Prime Minister David Cameron. UK intelligence agencies are seeking the identity of the masked man with an English accent who was filmed beheading US journalist James Foley in Syria, writes Mark Hennessy in the Irish Times. And Mr. Cameron has returned for talks with his foreign secretary and intelligence and military officers. Also on the front of the Times, Kitty Holland reports that the terms of reference for the inquiry into the care given to the young woman who says she was raped and refused an abortion but later had her pregnancy delivered at 25 weeks are due to be published today. And Michael Clifford in the Irish Examiner says as of now, the only group pushing for changes to the abortion regime are those broadly in favour of widespread availability for the procedure. The majority is not of that mind, certainly not yet. So it is easy for scared politicians to ignore that lobby. Change will come, he writes. It is no longer sustainable to maintain laws that visit cruelty on the most vulnerable on the basis of one particular religion. The Examiner leads with a report that suicide tourism is on the rise, with the number of people travelling to Switzerland to take their own lives doubling in 4 years. Catherine Shanahan says two people from Ireland feature among the growing number of suicide tourists who take advantage of Right to Die organisations which assist people in taking their own lives. And that's according to a report published in the Journal of Medical Ethics. Blasted in front of his four kids, says the Irish Sun, referring to the killing of Andy Connors. Girl saw her daddy blasted to death, is the Irish Daily Star's headline. And the Herald says a woman has been arrested over the murder of Alan Ryan. In other stories, Trump on collision course over Doonbeg turbine plan, says the Independent. Charlie Weston reporting that the lodging of fresh plans with Clare County Council follows Mr. Trump declaring in May that the council had killed the prospect of wind turbines being erected near Doonbeg. Yesterday, the executive vice president of the Trump Organization said, if we conclude that it jeopardizes our investment at Doonbeg, we will do whatever is necessary to fight it and protect the beauty of our site. We have a very good track record of fighting these monstrosities. Finally, my boss thinks I'll be back at work on Monday. That's the new Rose of Tralee from Philadelphia, Maria Walsh. Sean Murphy in The Star says Maria hasn't told her boss yet of her win. And Maria said, I told him I was taking part in this crazy Irish festival. And he said, very good, just don't come back with a crown.
to 12 minutes past seven. And if you've joined us since the beginning of the programme, I should tell you that we've heard of the sad news during the night of the death after a long illness of former Taoiseach Albert Reynolds. He was aged 81, and it's true of all Taoiseach, but particularly of Albert Reynolds, that he is someone who played a major role in bringing about the country and the island that is at peace as a result of the work that he brought to fruition, actually, almost exactly 20 years ago in 1994 with the declaration of the IRA ceasefire. And we'll be looking at Albert Reynolds' contribution to the life of this country and his life and his political life in particular between now and 9 o'clock. But now, as usual, let's get the early business news from Brian Finn.
Cathal, thank you. The pound and the US dollar made something of a comeback yesterday after recent weakness in the currencies. The renewed strength in sterling came about after two Bank of England policymakers were discovered to have voted in favour of increasing interest rates from 0.5 to 0.75% at the most recent policy meeting. Interest rate hikes in the UK were expected in the next year, but this might hasten their arrival, it's believed. The minutes of the most recent US Federal Reserve meeting also pointed towards some active debate about whether an early increase in rates might be warranted there. Briefy House Resort near Castlebar in County Mayo has been bought out of receivership. Hotel management company Great National Asset Management bought the company for the hotel for an undisclosed sum. The 230-room hotel and resort had been on the market for around €3 million. Great National says the purchase will secure the future of 120 jobs at the hotel. Computer maker Hewlett-Packard reported a slight surprise increase in its quarterly revenue for the second 3 months of the year. It was the first quarterly increase after 11 quarters of decline. Revenue came in at $27.6 billion despite an ongoing company restructuring. Four McDonald's outlets in Moscow have been temporarily shut as part of an investigation into food standards. The watchdog claimed the restaurants had breached numerous sanitary laws. McDonald's says it's looking into the complaints. The closure comes amid rising tensions between Russia and the West over the crisis in Ukraine. On the currencies this morning, the euro is trading at $1.32.5 and just below 80 pence sterling, Christopher.
We'll start our coverage now of the sad passing of Albert Reynolds. We, as you may have heard, if you've joined us since the programme came on air, he has passed away. He passed away during the night. Conor Hunt, our reporter, has put together an obituary for Albert Reynolds. We're going to hear from that now.
Ireland is on the move again. The new beginning has already started.
Albert Reynolds was a Fianna Fáil stalwart, leading the party in two coalition governments. For him, his most important political contribution was his work on the peace process.
It is a source of immense relief to all of us that the terrible cycle of deaths has been brought to an end.
He was born in Rooski in County Roscommon, and before entering politics was involved in the dance hall and pet food businesses. He was elected a TD for Longford West Meath in 1977 at the age of 45. It was the election made famous by the party's manifesto, which was full of sweeteners.
To be honest and repeat it again here, I never read that manifesto until after I was elected. They were packed in a brown box below my election headquarters in Longford. As far as I was concerned, I didn't need the manifesto.
2 years later, he was a key member of the backbench group, which helped topple the Taoiseach Jack Lynch. He was rewarded by Charlie Haughey, who appointed him as Minister for Posts and Telegraphs. In the 1980s, he became the Minister for Finance, but his intense dislike for being in coalition with the PDs added to cooling in his relations with Haughey, who portrayed Albert Reynolds as being part of the country and western wing of the party. It was an image seemingly not dismissed by him. The economy showed signs of moving out of recession during his time in finance, but he was dramatically sacked from the cabinet after supporting an abortive attempt to remove Haughey in 1991.
In fact, I'm flattered by the amount of support that was available for me, not even having campaigned at all in this situation. And there was a strong request that honourable time be given for the completion of an agenda. And we responded to that.
3 months later, though, Albert Reynolds finally got the top job when Haughey was ousted.
I just want to say a few words to you all before taking your questions. I am extremely honoured indeed to be the choice of my colleagues to lead the Fianna Fáil party in the 90s. Very honoured, very grateful to them. And conscious that I follow the special tradition of Eamon de Valera, Sean Damas, Jack Lynch and Charles Day Haughey.
Immediately, he caused a sensation by sacking eight of Haughey's ministers. The very next day, he was confronted with the X case crisis, where a 14-year-old girl was refused permission to travel abroad for an abortion. It was an issue which dominated much of his first period in office.
To the right to life.
He never liked being in coalition with the PDs, a temporary little arrangement, he called it. And at the Tribunal of Inquiry into the Beef Industry, he and Des O'Malley were deeply critical of each other. It was clear relations between Albert Reynolds and the PDs were at breaking point.
Will you meet Des O'Malley, Taoiseach, to talk to him and thrash it out with him?
My door is always open, as Taoiseach. It has always has been open to every minister of my government, including the two PD ministers. And it is nonsense for some PD or some people to suggest that Mr. Malloy or Mr. O'Malley never had meetings with me. That, as I said to the Tribunal or to the Sunday Tribune today, is crap, total crap.
A general election was called. He had served only 9 months as Taoiseach. Fianna Fáil went on to lose 9 seats and was forced into partnership with the Labour Party. Ireland secured a multi-billion pound deal in EU funds, and there were hopes the coalition would last the full course. But there were rows over passports for sale, a tax amnesty, and unemployment reached 300,000. He did, though, strike up a strong relationship with the British Prime Minister, John Major. His determination and deal-cutting skills led to the Downing Street Declaration in 1993.
This is a historic opportunity for peace. We hope that everybody will grasp it.
This was followed by the IRA ceasefire the following summer.
I don't mind what words you use as long as the effect is that this is the end of the 25 years of armed conflict. That is over. It's behind us. We go on from here.
One writer said it was his readiness to take a risk, cut corners, back a hunch and drive a hard deal that kept the entire peace process on course.
I worked away behind the scenes and we eventually got to the Downing Street Declaration. 15 months, imagine, we were working at that and not a single person in the media ever found out.
That's right.
It is not quite one. Fascinating.
And it showed the commitment on both sides to try and do something about it.
Despite the success, relations between the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach were seriously deteriorating. There was a huge flare-up with Dick Spring over the publication of the Beef Tribunal report and a bitter disagreement over the appointment of a High Court president and a related row over the Attorney-General's handling of the Brendan Smith case. After an extraordinary sequence of events, Fianna Fáil was forced out, although Labour remained in power with new partners without an election.
I have taken this decision for the good of the country, in the interests of stability, and in particular, to ensure the continuation of the peace process.
After politics, Mr. Reynolds returned to business life, but again was in the headlines when he controversially sued the Sunday Times for libel and was awarded only one penny. However, on appeal, he reached a settlement with the paper.
Now the contest was over, and we have a united candidate. And if, for some surprise, as there was some surprise in the room, there's no doubting that.
There were several more disappointments ahead. He was encouraged to seek the Fianna Fáil nomination for the presidency, but instead the party went with a northern-based lawyer, Mary McAleese.
Look, it's her day, it's not mine, so... Sure, I did twice already. Sorry?
Well, I mean, how do you feel?
I feel very surprised and deeply disappointed.
Another setback came in 2006 when the Reynolds pet food factory in County Longford was destroyed by fire.
To spend a lot of your life building up something.
In more recent times, Mr. Reynolds was criticised by the Mahon Tribunal for seeking donations for the party from developer Owen O'Callaghan. Mr. Reynolds, the tribunal found, had abused political power.
The Queen's... car now coming to the Garden of Remembrance.
The final breakthroughs of the peace process may not have happened during his tenure, but Albert Reynolds lived long enough to see the fruits of his work. As for his personal life, he said he, his wife Kathleen, and his children were blessed. When he stepped down as Taoiseach nearly 2 decades ago, he reserved his final words for them.
I thank them indeed for their commitment and for staying the course with me, and I look forward, as they do. And there was a very happy family there this morning to say farewell. Thank you.
Albert Reynolds, the former Taoiseach who has died during the night, making his final speech as Taoiseach just before resigning in 1994, an occasion, a sad occasion, which many people will remember, and which came, let us remember, as Conor Hunt's report made clear on his life's work, which came within weeks of his greatest achievement and one which has influenced the country in which we live and the island in which we live, the achievement of peace and the first IRA ceasefire. Joining us now is Brian Dowling of our political staff. And Brian, we should begin, I think, with that, because it is outstandingly the greatest thing he did for everyone who lived and lives in this country. Just tell us about that, what he achieved 20 years ago this month.
I think, Cathal, the scale of that achievement, when you look at it now with the benefit of hindsight and you have a political perspective on what has happened in the interim years, you realise just how momentous that period was. And for a long part of that period, Cathal, it has to be said, Albert Reynolds, to some extent, was in a very lonely position. He was one of a very, very small number of people who believed that it would be possible to chart a way through the violence in Northern Ireland and to bring about a peace process. And there were many, many people, including some of his colleagues and people across the political spectrum, who doubted that. But perhaps himself, along with John Hume, might have been the two nationalist politicians who most had committed themselves to trying to find that way through the morass and all the difficulties and the mayhem in the north. And it really was his crowning political achievement. But it didn't come easy, because it really required a lot of people to work very, very hard and very long hours in the background. And I think in that clip we heard there just a couple of moments ago, he talked about, I think, some 18 months of work behind the scenes. And a central part of this really was the relationship that he developed with John Major. That became absolutely crucial. The two leaders, himself and the British Prime Minister, developed a level of trust, and a level of trust that is really the absolute bedrock of being able to pull together a process of this magnitude. And in the long, long months leading up to the negotiations for the Downing Street Declaration in 1993, there were many, many points along the way when it looked as though this could all fall apart. There were torturous hours of negotiations between British and Irish officials and working between the various groups in the north in terms of trying to agree the wording of the declaration, a wording that, if you like, could carry everybody to a different space. And that sort of intensive negotiation to find formulas of words. I think one being, I think people may recall the phrase concurrent elections or concurrent mandates, North and South, the idea that there would have to be one vote on the island and that that vote would have to be held concurrently, both North and South, and for whenever an agreement would be reached, that ultimately became the Good Friday Agreement. There's no doubt about that. I think in December 1993, when the declaration, the Downing Street Declaration, was agreed and published, Albert Reynolds said shortly after that, that really, this is really only of significance if it brings about peace. It took another while yet. It was August 1994 when the first IRA ceasefire was called, and people may recall those very iconic images of Albert Reynolds as Taoiseach greeting both John Hume and Gerry Adams on the steps of government buildings.
Johnny Fallon, a man who knew him well, has reminded us in a piece he's written online about the misery and the bloodshed through which Albert Reynolds as Taoiseach had to work, and it was a role for which he was often criticised and those around him in trying to make the contacts, and many of them were difficult and many of them had to be secret, that were to bring about that peace. But in this month, 20 years ago, as Johnny reminds us, for example, the UVF killed a Protestant man they said was an informer in West Belfast. The IRA shot dead a part-time member of the British Army in County Down. The UFF, a loyalist group, shot a Catholic security guard in Belfast. The IRA bombed a pub. There was an IRA bomb in Britain. And that's the world in which Albert Reynolds and those around him had to work to bring about that first IRA ceasefire, which was to lead to paramilitary ceasefires on all sides eventually, and, as I say, the peaceful island in which we work. And somebody who knows well what that work was and what it achieved is also on the line. Stay with us, Brian. Tommy Gorman, our Northern editor. The significance and of what he achieved and how hard it was, Tommy.
Function last December, Cathal, to mark the 20th anniversary of the Downing Street Declaration. It was held in the Department of Foreign Affairs. And it was a very moving occasion because John Major came across to speak at that. And Albert Reynolds was represented at it by his family. His wife Kathleen and his family members were there. He was too ill to attend. And John Major made a point of going to see Albert Reynolds and having a private meeting with him. Such was the strength of their relationship and the respect that John Major had for him, and I suppose the knowledge that John Major had of what had taken place behind the scenes. Because in many respects, Albert Reynolds' greatest strength was he was a deal maker. He would say to a person, these are the terms, these are the conditions, and if you meet them, I'll honour my word. I remember talking to Sinn Féin people at that time, and what they found different about Albert Reynolds was when he was, say, for instance, Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, as it was then, he employed people who had been of a Republican background who were finding it hard to get jobs in the state at that stage. These were people who had left their past behind them. And he said, if you leave your baggage outside and you do the job, that's good enough for me. And they're the kind of qualities, I think, that he brought to negotiations. He didn't just talk to the likes of Sinn Féin. And remember, not many people were talking to them at that stage. He also spoke to Gusty Spence. He had the trust of people like Father Alec Reid. And as well as having the Downing Street Declaration, then he followed through for what was the IRA ceasefire. Ironically, and in some ways quite sadly, he didn't live just long enough for that 20th anniversary, which is coming up at the end of this month, the 31st of August.
Stay with us, Tommy and Brian, because we'll be coming to other aspects of his life, many of them controversial in a moment, but I think we should stick for the moment with what was undoubtedly his greatest achievement. And we're joined also on the line. And Tommy and Brian, if you want to come in on this, just come in as you wish, but also joined by somebody else who worked with him closely in bringing about that first IRA ceasefire 20 years ago this month. I think on the line now we have the former Labour advisor to the then Taoiseach Dick Spring, Fergus Finlay. Good morning, and thank you for talking to us on what is a sad occasion, but nevertheless one to remember what this man did. What was your, because your relationship with him was fraught at times, but just in terms of what that government and that Taoiseach achieved 20 years ago this month, how will you remember him and what led up to it?
Well, I think the thing that he'll never be forgotten for is the thing that we've been talking about, or that you've been talking about. And what I remember about Albert Reynolds in that context, the context of the IRA ceasefire and the Downing Street Declaration, was that he was dealing with a British government that was very heavily dependent on unionist support. It wasn't like later times when, you know, you had Tony Blair with a 200-seat majority and a commitment to trying to do something. John Major was, in some respects, a reluctant partner who had to be dragged kind of kicking and screaming into this process. And it is to Albert Reynolds' eternal credit that he won him over. He was the most dogged, the most persistent, the most straightforward, the most single-minded person I think I've ever met in terms of the pursuit of an objective. Nobody knew when he was elected that this was going to be the thing that he would set his mind to do. But he set his mind to do it with the most extraordinary passion and commitment. I think Brian made the point earlier that sometimes that was a very lonely place to be. Not too many people believed that he would succeed in negotiating the Downing Street Declaration, and not too many people believed that he would succeed in bringing about the IRA ceasefire. But as Tommy has said, he did much more than that. He opened lines of communication to the Combined Loyalist Military Command. He insisted on having incorporated in the Downing Street Declaration their so-called six principles of non-discrimination within Northern Ireland. And that was very instrumental in its own way in securing their ceasefire and their apology. When the history of that period is written, and as Tommy says, in about 12 days' time, those who want to are going to be in a position to celebrate the 20th anniversary of this. It's incredibly poignant that he won't be around for that, because it is a singular achievement. And it's a singular achievement that cannot be gainsaid. John Hume was, in some ways, the great architect of all this process. But every great project needs an engineer, and if Hume was the architect, Albert Reynolds was the engineer.
All right, we'll come on to the other aspects of his life, because there's much more to Albert Reynolds, although we've been talking, I think, about the most important. I think we'd all agree on this. But just, we'll come to the news headlines now. But just before we do, just on this question of what he achieved in Northern Ireland in 20 years ago this month, Brian or Tommy, do you want to add anything to what you've heard from Fergus?
Well, Tommy Gorman. Fergus is so right. And I think what's important about Albert Reynolds is those relationships stayed in place. He would still be highly respected in loyalist circles. There would be the recognition within the Republican movement that it was on his watch that those sacrifices were made and those stretches were made by people. And I also think that it was so moving that night in the Department of Foreign Affairs that, say, for instance, Dick Spring, who had his differences with Albert Reynolds towards the end of their time in coalition, that Dick Spring sat alongside the Reynolds family at that event, because in many respects, in marking the 20th anniversary of the Downing Street Declaration, that really was a very public tribute to Albert Reynolds. It started then, and I think it sort of explains, Cahill, in many respects, why he wanted to stay in power, because the Downing Street Declaration was important, but the follow-through for it, the IRA ceasefire of 1994, which eventually held, which led to the Good Friday Agreement, that was the second important diplomatic effort. First of all, you had the Downing Street Declaration, and then you had the IRA ceasefire in August of 1994.
And there were, if I can... I mean, there were so many opportunities to shy away. I mean, I'm thinking as we speak, Tommy has mentioned some of the specific things that happened in the month, but there were some incredibly dark days within... While these negotiations were going on, while public officials were travelling backwards and forwards, while drafting of language was going on, the IRA blew up Frizzell's fish shop in the Shankill Road, and then because an IRA bomber was among Thomas Begley, I think was his name, was among those who were killed. There was the spectacle of Gerry Adams carrying his coffin, which. I think was the occasion when John Major said his stomach had been turned. These were moments when, in the middle of an intensifying process, when it would have in some ways been easier to walk away than to stick with it. And there was never a moment when anybody detected from Albert Reynolds that he wanted to walk away.
All right, and I think anyone who is, particularly anyone who wasn't born at that time or has been born since then, we're concentrating on what he achieved and those around him achieved, including yourself, Fergus Finlay, because you live in the island that he helped bring about and make a place of peace.
Dez is here with the sports.
Yeah, good morning, Christopher. The reason why Malky Mackay was not confirmed as manager of Crystal Palace yesterday is emerging. The FA in England is launching an investigation into the conduct of Mackay and Ian Moody over alleged sexist, racist and homophobic text messages sent during their time at Cardiff City. Mackay, the former Cardiff manager, and Moody, who was the club's former head of recruitment, he's now working at Crystal Palace, they've been reported to the FA over alleged misconduct in an exhaustive document compiled by the Cardiff chairman, Vincent Tan. The dossier is believed to include details of their transfer dealings and thousands of text messages and emails which are explicit and offensive. Some of the messages reported by the Daily Mail today are serious enough for the FA to consider making a thorough investigation of its own. Moody is now on the verge of leaving Palace after the revelations, with sources describing his position as untenable, while Mackay's hopes of landing the job there are over. In the action on the field last night, Celtic drew 1-1 in their Champions League playoff with Maribor. That's the first leg. Second leg to come in Glasgow. Callum McGregor got the crucial away goal for Celtic. Here at home, the Republic of Ireland's women team defeated Slovenia 2-0 in their World Cup qualifier at Tallaght Stadium. Fiona O'Sullivan and Julianne Russell got the goals. Ireland are 2 points behind second place Russia with 2 games left. In the English Championship, Fulham were booed off the pitch as they lost again, a 1-0 defeat at home to Wolves. There are just 2 Irish swimmers in action this morning at the European Championships in Berlin, as Fiona Doyle and Sarika McMahon compete in the heats of the women's 200 metres breaststroke. There was another gold medal for Ireland at the IPC European Championships yesterday, Michael McKillop winning the T38 800 metres in Swansea. In Gaelic games, the Carlow County Board is to hold an open forum next Monday prior to the selection of a new football manager. It's open to the public and will feature a discussion on the future of the game in the county. In hockey, the Irish women's team beat France 6-0 at UCD last night in the Tri Nations tournament. And in horse racing, Australia is now likely to go in the Irish Champion Stakes next month after its success in winning the Judmont International at York. The Aidan O'Brien trained 3-year-old with the son Joseph on board won by 2 lengths from the Grey Gatsby. Well, after that triumph with Australia, the O'Briens made the trip to Killarney where they teamed up to win the final race on the card with Red Rocks Point. Now, the feature race at York today is the Yorkshire Oaks, while the Killarney meeting continues at 5:10 this evening.
19 minutes to 8 o'clock on this morning, morning we're marking the passing of the former Taoiseach Albert Reynolds. On the line, former Government Minister Mary O'Rourke. Mary O'Rourke, good morning to you.
Hello, good morning.
Your thoughts this morning?
Well, sadness for Kathleen and for her family. They're so devoted. Really, I know it sounds hackney, but it's absolutely true. He had the love of his life in his wife Kathleen and of his family, and all of that was so deep rooted and so genuine with him. My thoughts are with her and with her family, and they've cared for him so diligently and so lovingly over the past number of years. I don't know that directly. I only know what people tell me, but I know it to be true. So God be good to him.
Now, you were a cabinet minister with a pretty stellar career behind you by the time Albert Reynolds took over as Taoiseach in 2002. He didn't have a place for you in his cabinet.
Ah, no. And for seven, there were 8 senior ministers and 10 junior ministers with one fell swoop. And, you know, that was, he's right. We all fumed and roared and shouted and gave out. But, you know, in hindsight, very quickly after that, I realised that was his right because he was the new broom. And he didn't want old dust lying around. Now, he made me a junior minister pretty immediately after that, and we got on well. Well as rivals in a constituency can get on. You see, as well as being both cabinet ministers, we were both rivals in Longford Westmeath.
Well, let's take you back a little bit then, a little bit earlier. Describe the constituency of Longford Westmeath, the two of you looking for votes there, the two of you working that constituency, and both being so senior in Fianna Fáil.
Yes, it was a very interesting dilemma. I mean, I was very conscious that Albert had been a TD before me, but I was also conscious we had to live together in the one constituency. It was great for the party because the intense rivalry for votes, we actually fought over votes, loads of incidents like the Battle of Tang, which was a vote gathering exercise after Mass on a Sunday in my neck of the woods, but bearing into Ballymahon and all his area, in which I and all my men and my lorry arrived after for 10 Mass on Sunday, and he with his lorry, a far more superior lorry.
But he was a prominent businessman.
He was a very prominent businessman. He was a very strong candidate, a very strong person. And Longford kept faith with him and a good part of Westmeath as well. So in 87, we got 3 seats for Fianna Fáil. The intense rivalry gave that. But really, that was part of his ruggedness, if you like, to put a word upon it. And he brought that same energy to bear upon his prime ministerial duties, Taoiseach's duties, when he fought so tenaciously for peace. And I hear you talking, you're going to have Martin Manser, he will give you day and date and time of all that. He had 2 aims, he told me. One aim was to bring peace to Ireland, and the second aim was to build up the economy of Ireland. And he succeeded in the first, and he partially succeeded in the second. You see, he had a businessman's approach. What do you do? Mm. You go after a thing you want. You go after it doggedly and determinedly, and he did that.
Can I ask you, obviously both of you in cabinet under Charlie Haughey, now clearly his relationship with Charlie Haughey soured in the end, yours not so. What was his relationship, what was his bread and butter, his working relationship with Charlie Haughey like during the time when he held, say, the Department of Finance, that portfolio, a crucial portfolio in the lead up to the euro, the creation of the euro?
Yes, I think that's when it got a bit, not so much tattered, as a bit fraught, because he had begun to be seen as the heir by the backbenchers and by the public, the Fianna Fáil public in general, as the heir, the natural heir to Charlie Hoey, and then that led to the odd bit of tension around the cabinet table. But he worked away at his brief. He was a very strong Minister for Finance. I remember I was Minister for Education at the time, and I remember various bilaterals with him. He stuck to his guns, I stuck to mine. But he was able to do a deal with you, which is not always possible with your Minister for Finance, but he was. But his relationship with Charlie deteriorated when Charlie gave him the sack, and then he planned his coming back, his rebuttal, which I'd no doubt he knew he would do, because Charlie Hoey was coming to the end of his tenure anyway. So, but it was full of frissons and liveliness before that. But they each did their job.
For those who perhaps don't have a memory stretching back as far as yours and mine, can I ask you, for people who wouldn't have heard it, it's the stuff of legend, the Country and Western Alliance. Explain to us what that was and how it operated within Fianna Fáil.
Well, that was a note of which Charlie Hoey thought would be a note of a derogatory note, in which himself and Pádraig Flynn, who was also from the west of Ireland, and to a certain extent Maura Geoghegan Quinn, because they were in the group who left cabinet, Noel Tracy as well, who left cabinet after the when Albert was sacked, and others who went voluntarily, and Charlie Hoey seeking to denigrate them, call them the Country and Western Group, which was because they were from the west of Ireland, I guess. And then Albert had been the showman in his earlier life. He had been a dancehall promoter, and I suppose it had echoes in that as well.
We're going to bring Brian Dowling back in of our political staff, Brian, because with Mary O'Rourke we've been touching on Albert Reynolds' time as Minister for Finance. It was crucial in the life of this nation because, of course, it was the period leading up to the Maastricht Treaty and negotiations on same, which of course led ultimately to the single currency. That period of time, that 3-year period when he was Minister for Finance.
His tenure in finance, really, to some extent, Christopher, that became a mark of Albert Reynolds, because much as I think Fergus Finlay mentioned earlier about his determination and his single-mindedness about certain issues, he also was a very, very practical business person in his own right, and he brought that can-do business approach to his role both in industry and commerce at an earlier period and in finance, but also particularly to his negotiations in Europe. And I think many people, older listeners, might recall in that period he famously negotiated a deal on structural funds, I think if I remember correctly, for £6 billion
as it
was.
£7 billion
as it was,
yes.
Then. And
and he became known as the Minister for the £7 billion or the £8 billion or whatever it was, as you say, the debate continues.
Also known, as I remember, as a million a day.
And there were many people at that time who somehow doubted just how real this deal was. But in fact, that deal came to fruition. And I think if my recollection is correct, it became fairly central as well in terms of the formation of the government with the Labour Party, in that there was, if you like, a chest of money
and roads to be built, if I remember,
to develop the infrastructure of the country. So that while Albert Reynolds rightly is remembered for the extraordinary negotiations and effort in relation to peace in the north, he actually did lay foundations for a lot of the economic recovery and the economic regeneration of the country, particularly the country's infrastructure.
Mary O'Rourke, I'll leave the last word to you. Just a final memory of Albert Reynolds, given that you worked with him so closely during the 1980s in cabinet.
Well, I remember the robust nature of the relationship, up and down and in and out. We were rivals, we were political rivals, but strangely, we ended up very well together. We ended up as friends, in so much as you can be that, and in one constituency. But I remember him for his devotion to Kathleen to him, his family, how much they meant to him. And for me, that was such a sterling quality in a busy, busy person. He never lost touch.
And Longford perhaps a little darker today.
all Longford will really read. They always speak of him during the recent by-election there. I met up with so many who had been his stalwart supporters, and they always spoke so highly of him. I just, in the old-fashioned way, God be good to him and to his family now.
Mary O'Rourke, thank you very much. Also, Brian Dowling. We'll be looking at back after 8 o'clock more on Albert Reynolds' life and times, including that crucial work in Northern Ireland and also that crucial work in Europe. Let's go to Brian Finn and the business news.
Christopher, thank you. Brafey House Resort near Castle Bar has been bought out of receivership. Hotel management company Great National Asset Management bought the company for an undisclosed sum. The 230-room hotel and resort had been on the market with a guide price of around €3 million. Now, global stock markets are creeping back up after recent geopolitical tensions took their toll on investor sentiment. Elsewhere, the dollar is at a one-year high and the pound has regained some of the value it lost of late. To analyse these moves, Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets is here. Paul, starting with the stock markets, why are they going back up when global tensions seem still to be apparent?
Yeah, extremely interesting times. One thing is that volumes are very light in August, so we are trading higher on very light volumes. But the thing to remember is that the geopolitical tensions haven't really been an issue for financial markets over the last couple of months. We can tell that by the price of gold, which is down below 1300. Oil is at a 9-month low, actually. So it's not the geopolitical tensions that the traders are interested in. The only thing they've been interested in for some time is what the central banks are going to do and how they're going to do it and how fast or slowly they're going to act if inflation comes into the economies.
And we saw minutes released from the US Federal Reserve's most recent meeting yesterday, which caused the dollar to go up overnight. What did they indicate to cause that?
Well, this is why it's the most interesting, because we had the minutes from two central banks yesterday, first from the UK. Now, the UK, two of the members were the first time since 2011 actually voted for an interest rate increase. Now, that is very surprising. So what we can tell is that the UK is likely to be the first major economy to put up interest rates. Then we got the Fed minutes, and the Fed, while they're discussing the slack in the economy, they are worried a little bit and saying to themselves, right, well, we might have to put up interest rates at some point. But again, the financial markets are saying to themselves, these guys aren't going to put up interest rates anytime soon. And that's why the equity markets have moved to all-time highs again. The markets are quite relaxed that Janet Yellen will not do anything proactive. She will probably wait till inflation comes into the system and then might act afterwards.
And Janet Yellen will be speaking this weekend at the Jackson Hole Summit of Central Bankers. What are we likely to hear from her? Will she give anything away at these summits?
Well, yes, the financial markets are expecting her to, she'll be making a large speech tomorrow, and what we're expecting for is some soothing words. So what we're expecting her to say is, look, okay, the unemployment rate is falling in the USA, but the statistics aren't particularly good in that. So what we're expecting her to say is, look, I've got my hands on the tiller. I'm not likely to do anything very fast, very quickly. And so you guys can continue to buy risk assets and continue to push the markets up. That is her main objective, to push asset prices up all around the world to try to get confidence back in the world economy.
One area where they won't be increasing interest rates anytime soon is in the EU. Mario Draghi has quite a problem on his hands with dire statistics and economic indicators coming in the last week. What's he have to do now?
Well, the European economy is, you know, absolutely dismal, and you can see how far behind they are, you know, compared to, say, the UK or the US, where the UK and the US might be putting up interest rates soon. The ECB, we're looking for them to actually put in quantitative easing. So they're about a couple of years behind anything that was done by the other central banks. So I would expect the ECB later on in the year to try quantitative easing, to try other extraordinary measures to try and get the European economy moving. But you can see by the German indices, you know, the German indices lost about 10% over the last couple of months. And that obviously is to do with the Russian tensions, but also it's to do with the biggest engine in Europe is really faltering.
With the Bank of England, the talk had been probably sometime, maybe in the spring of next year, they would increase interest rates. With that dissent in the vote that we saw yesterday, might that bring that forward?
Yes, I would say that would definitely bring that forward. It might be even late this year. I would expect a UK interest rate probably late this year or early next year. But again, don't be too worried if you're an investor, because when they start putting up interest rates, it's likely to be very slowly and very gradually.
Okay, Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets, thank you very much indeed. Just finally on the currencies, the euro is trading at $1.32.5 and just below 80 pence sterling, Christopher.
At 4 minutes to 8, it's over to Matt Aaron and Gerry Murphy.
Thank you very much indeed, Christopher, and a very good morning from Met Erin. Well, over the past week, our weather has become quite cool as northerly breezes have dominated, and they'll continue to dominate to between now and Saturday, with a fair amount of dry weather, but some rain or drizzle or showers at times too. We see a significant change from Sunday onwards, heavy rain moving across the country, and then into next week, the weather coming from the southwest, quite unsettled, but it will be that bit milder. Now, today will be mostly cloudy. This morning, while there will be a few bright spots here and there, a good deal of cloud with scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle in many areas. However, amounts of rain and drizzle will be quite small, and then we will see brighter weather and a few showers gradually following from the north as we go through this afternoon and evening as that rain and drizzle clears away to the south. Highest temperatures today of 14 to 17 degrees with moderate to fresh westerly breezes. Tonight then will be mainly dry with clear spells, however there will be some scattered showers on west and north coasts, and the temperatures will fall to between 5 and 8 degrees. Tomorrow Friday then we'll have a mainly dry and bright start with good sunny spells, however we will see those scattered showers on west and north coasts gradually extending southwards through the late morning and early afternoon. Many of the showers tomorrow will be quite light and there'll be a good deal of dry and bright weather as well. Highest temperatures tomorrow again 14 to 17 degrees with moderate northwest breezes. And then into the weekend, Saturday will be another cool and bright day with sunny spells and just a few showers, these mainly over Ulster and Leinster. But as I said, we'll see a significant change on Sunday. It will start off mainly dry, but then we'll see heavy rain developing in the southwest in the morning and gradually spreading northeastwards to all areas and becoming widespread by evening. There'll be a risk of flooding, especially in the southern half of the country, and fresh southeast winds. After that rain clears away, we'll see plenty of heavy showers through Monday and Tuesday next, the weather continuing unsettled next week, but it will become that bit milder. But in the meantime, for today, a mostly cloudy day with scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle, which will gradually clear southwards later on. That's the forecast. Good morning.